I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Money Matters with MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Today we're going to talk with Sarah Johnson, who is the executive director of the Baltimore Cash Campaign, short for Creating Assets, Savings, and Hope Campaign. And Sarah, welcome. Good to meet you.
Thank you. So good to be here.
So let's talk a bit about what the Cash Campaign is for listeners who have not heard of this before.
Sure. Well, as you said, Cash stands for Creating Assets, Savings, and Hope. And we're a coalition of partners that have been around for 10 years. The coalition comprises of partners who are both in the nonprofit community, but also financial institutions, government agencies, who really work together to provide economic opportunities for low and moderate income families in Baltimore.
Now, I was interested, before we went on the air, we're talking about part of what you're doing is working with people who are 55 and older trying to figure out how to manage their money.
Right.
Because it's a frightening time for a lot of people getting to that age.
Yes, that's right.
And not having any assets or very few assets.
Yep. Yeah, so we're part of a national demonstration project with the National Council on Aging, and we're actually really looking at ways to connect folks that are 55 and older with opportunities to increase their income and stabilize their income. So everything from connecting them to our free tax preparation services, which is really our flagship and the core work that we do around free tax preparation. But Cash has really expanded to be able to provide services 365 around people's finances. And so specifically looking at this audience of people to make sure that they are connected to health resources, benefits access, as well as tax prep during the season.
But now you have this program starting in the fall. Financial fitness?
Yeah, we have a lot of exciting things that are coming up. So the financial fitness series, we bring in experts and we actually are hosted by the Enoch Pratt Library. People can go to our website or sign up for our e-newsletter to learn more about things as they come available. But these are free. We do all kinds of things on starting your own business, on understanding how to file your taxes, all kinds of really interesting things that go on throughout the year.
You want people to participate, but I understand you're also looking for folks to volunteer to do some of the teaching.
We are. We're always looking for volunteers. In fact, we train over 190 volunteers every year just during tax season, not to mention all the volunteers we work with during the year. So we're always looking for people who might have skills that they want to offer. We have a really interesting program called Cash Coaches that offers one-on-one financial coaching for people who are looking for a little assistance around creating a budget or meeting their financial goals. So if folks out there are interested in volunteering who may have some expertise in this field and would like to become a cash coach, we'd love to talk to you. Or if you're interested in getting some financial coaching, we'd love for you to register so we can work with you.
So tell me again, if I'm really in need of kind of figure out where I am financially and really stuck in a hard place and I'm over 55, I mean, what happens if I come see you?
So we will either be able to provide direct coaching and support to you one-on-one, or we would be able to refer you to one of our coalition partners who specifically works with perhaps someone who's a senior or around your finances. So we may refer you to the Money Helpline, and that is a collaboration with Credit Counseling Services of Maryland and Delaware and Maryland Cash Campaign. And I have that number handy if you're interested.
Please
so
do.
That is 1-877-254-1097. That's the Money Helpline. And that's for anyone. That's not just for someone who's low to moderate income. Anyone can call that number and receive some quick coaching on the phone or a resource.
Now, do you have a website you talked about earlier that people can...
Sure. So BaltimoreCashCampaign.org is where you can sign up for our e-newsletter to learn about events or where you can go on to register to be a volunteer or learn about any of the various activities going on, including free tax preparation. Please visit any of our 15 sites around the city come tax time.
Sarah Johnson, Executive Director of the Baltimore Cash Campaign. Pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thanks so much.
Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. MeQ, invest in yourself and we'll invest in you. For more information, 1-800-248-MECU or www.mecu.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. There are a number of issues that we cover a great deal on the show, as you've known over the years, and one of those issues has to do with things that affect our environment, but as importantly, things we're calling these days environmental justice that affects many communities of color around this country and in our own state of Maryland, our own communities here surrounding Baltimore. One has been highlighted by both the Sun and especially by the Baltimore Brew because of one of our guests, Mark Reuter, who worked for a long time for the Sun and went off and became a journalist and professor and scholar, and wrote the book Making Steel Sparrows Point, and wrote a series of stories about what's going on in Turner Station with pollution from the old Beth Steel plant, and joins us in studio right at this moment. Mark, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Great
Thank
to see you
Mark.
Again. Haven't seen you since our last beer, which is a while ago.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Maxine Thompson is with us. She's a resident of Turner Station and a longtime advocate and fighter for the residents of our neighborhood and for cleaning up the pollution and the numbers of people in Turner Station who have died from cancer. We'll talk all about that and more. And Maxine, it's lovely to meet you and welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And John Mueller has joined us up here in our studios in Hamden, came all the way from Annapolis, where he's vice president of litigation for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation that filed a suit in this case. And we'll talk about that as well. And John, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And I want to start off by we did invite the Department of Environment to come. And we did invite the steel company that owns the property now, Severstal, to come. And we did invite the previous owners, ArcelorMittal, which is an Indian-owned company, to join us as well. Severstal is a Russian-owned company, if I have that right. And so this is – let me just read their statements to you, and then we'll kind of cover what this topic is about. Sherry T. Wilson is secretary for the Maryland Department of the Environment, who's been a guest on the show before. She issued this statement when we requested that she join us on the show today. The 2,300-acre Sparrows Point property is perhaps the most complex cleanup site in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. The original focus of the Sparrows Point consent decree was to investigate and assess more than 100 years of industrial pollution, much of it occurring before the environmental laws of the 1970s. However, since 2008, the Department of Environment has pressed the site's owners to move from assessment to the much-needed cleanup work. This approach has also added more specific cleanup deadlines. One of MDE's, that's the Maryland Department of the Environment, top priorities is requiring Severstal, the owner of the mill, to address off-site contamination, a goal shared by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. Severstal is required to inform us of what it intends to do by the end of this month. We understand the residents' serious concerns. We also want the cleanup to move faster. But Marylanders should know that progress is being made in the complex and difficult endeavor to clean up Sparrows Point, and the department will continue to press aggressively for more action. Severstal, the owner, told Justin Levy, one of our producers, it's their company policy not to comment on pending litigation, so they wouldn't comment further. ArcelorMittal told us, the former company that owned the mill, ArcelorMittal, has not returned our calls yet. They told The Sun they won't comment on pending litigation either. So that was the statements of the parties that we did invite who did not come into the studio today. Let's talk a bit, let me start with you, Mark. I want to just give you your perspective of an overview here, because the articles that I've been reading that you've written for The Brew, and tell us why you did these articles and what you were looking at, and then we'll launch into our broader discussion with all three of our guests.
What first got me into writing about this over a year ago was partly the intent to file a lawsuit by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, which talked about pollution in Sparrows Point, which I had written about in my book. And what interested me was the rise of pollution in Sparrows Point, which I describe in detail in the book. And it was pollution that really didn't occur over the last 100 years. It really began occurring in the 1940s and 50s when Sparrows Point changed its production system from having hand rolling mills to continuous mills that required vast amounts more water to come through the system. And this water became contaminated with pickling sulfuric acid, and the serious pollution of the waters surrounding Sparrows Point really began around 1945. And the state had environmental laws. They had a law on the books that had been established many years before, thou shalt not pollute the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, and they were routinely ignored. At that time, Bethlehem Steel had a very significant figure and consultant who worked with them on water pollution interests, and it was Dr. Abel Wollman of Johns Hopkins University. He was also the consultant for the City Public Works Department, And so there was a very interesting relationship of the city government through Back River Water Treatment Plant in Baltimore County, the state government, and Bethlehem Steel and Dr. Wollman of setting up this pattern of massive, widespread pollution. Now, remember, in the 40s and 50s, Sparrows Point became the biggest steel mill in the world. It doubled in size, was producing, on average, 10 tons of steel a minute. So the origins go back to the 40s and 50s. In the 60s, there were massive fish kills and other problems that Maxine well knows about. And there was a very ineffective response by the state government. Beginning in the 1980s, there became, with the Clean Water Act and others, some at least response by the government, some fines to then Bethlehem Steel, which they paid. So what was interesting is that we're really looking over almost a 50-year or maybe even 60-year time period of rampant pollution of bay waters. And what was interesting was that even though the steel mill has declined in capacity and size, it's still a large steel mill in this country. And what the Chesapeake Bay Foundation cited was that pollution actually has deteriorated in water pollution since the consent decree, which was the culmination of the first round of government regulation, was signed. So we actually, I thought, and began investigating, is has the state, has the company gone backwards, and has the problem become even worse in this period where there was a where there was supposed to be a cleanup, had it in fact deteriorated? I looked at many files from MDE, Maryland Department of Environment, through Freedom of Information Act, and that's where a lot of my reporting beginning a year ago stems from.
Now, we're talking about a situation, and we got other guests in here. We're talking about a situation where the pollution has taken place in our Bay Area around Dundalk, but specifically around Turner Station and some surrounding communities. That, and we'll talk about what these means, that one of the things we've been reading in these articles is there's a very large hydrocarbon plume that's underneath this site that is, whose composition is very similar to what we're seeing in the Gulf in terms of what's in that plume right now with the BP oil spill. And that the company that wants to rebuild there in that area and put a gas plant in, a liquefying plant, is the one that actually found out that this that the Patapsco River and the surrounding areas are filled with chromium, copper, lead, mercury, zinc, and a lot of other toxic chemicals. And that one of the things that we've been talking about in these stories is that Maxine Thompson and her late aunt, Phyllis Seward, who died of cancer, are the numbers, and really I don't think a study's really been done about this thoroughly, but the numbers of Turner Station residents who have died of cancer and have other diseases that many people assume could be linked to the toxins that are in the water that and in the ground and leaking into the water people use and other things as well. So this is what we're talking about here. And before we turn to Maxine to get a kind of a personal community sense of what's going on here and your struggles, I want to turn to our other guest first, just so our listeners get a sense of what's going on here. John Mueller, who's Vice President for Litigation at Chesapeake Bay Foundation. You are filing a lawsuit. Is it tomorrow?
No, it's already been filed.
Filed last Friday.
Correct.
I have my Fridays mixed up.
Right.
Last week against the two steel companies.
Right.
Talk a bit about that.
The current owner and operator, Severstal, and the former owner and operator, which was Mittal. It became emerged with Arcelor, became ArcelorMittal. So that's the other company that we sued. The predecessors are all gone, either out of business or
Bethlehem Steel being the major predecessor that was there, right?
Correct. And, you know, CBF has been involved with Sparrows Point for some time. You know, back in the 80s, we brought some of the initial Clean Water Act claims against the company for violating the Clean Water Act and discharging into the Patapsco River. And that's when the government started to get more involved, pay attention. And as Mark stated, there was a consent decree entered by the court to end that case. And the consent decree required a lot of different studies under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, a federal law that deals with hazardous waste. And I think everyone, and I'm sure Maxine probably felt this way, and the folks at Turner Station believed that things were proceeding as they were supposed to under the consent decree. But it wasn't until, as you pointed out, the AES LNG plant proposal for a portion of the Sparrows Point site, they did some studies to try and determine the feasibility of it and what effect that would have on contamination or pollution existing in the harbor in Patapsco. And when we read the reports and saw that, in fact, pollution levels had gone up, not down, it raised a number of red flags for us. And so we got much more involved looking at, had the consent decree been followed? Were there other violations of federal law going on there? And most importantly, you know, have the contaminants gone beyond the boundaries of the plant itself and now exposing the people of Turner Station and other people that live in Bear Creek and recreate on the Patapsco River?
So now Turner Station, I mean, Turner Station is one of our historically old African-American neighborhoods. Started out with, it was a place, just for our listeners who don't know, Turner Station is a community in its own right by Dundalk. In the early 1900s, there were a few hundred black folks who moved there because they were working in the mills or working in the plants, and they weren't allowed to live in Dundalk, so they bought land from Mr. Turner, and they created Turner Station. And then in the late 40s, early 50s, there were 10,000 people living in Turner Station, and it was a huge, incredibly stable, working-class, middle-class black community by the water, with most of the residents working in the steel plants. And that's your neighborhood, Maxine Thompson.
That is correct. And the reason I have gotten so involved in this, because I'm a third-generation Turner Station resident. My grandparents migrated here from the South, too, and my grandfather was employed at Bethlehem Steel. And when we were growing up, we swam in the water, we fished in the water, and it was clear. We could see through to the bottom. Actually, we washed the tadpoles and watched the perch and catch perch, and my grandmother would fry them up as soon as we brought them out of the water. So, and they lived directly on the water.
Right.
And as the years went by, the waters got darker. We started seeing fish kills. We were getting different kinds of odors from the water. And I had moved away from Turner Station for several years, for about 20 years, and I moved back. But I started noticing that a lot of the women in my age group were having breast cancer. There were all sorts of incidents of cancer, and I noticed that most of the people who were getting this cancer lived directly on the water in Turner Station. And that's still going on, and my concern is, even more for my personal health as well as the community, that I move back into a hotbed where, you know, so many people are coming down with cancer. There's also a lot of respiratory problems that are going on within Turner Station. And I understand they were supposed to have been doing the cleanup in Turner Station and cleaning up Spurs Point, and they created this landfill, which is directly across from Turner Station, where they're supposed to be dumping all these contaminants, which is even further polluting the community.
So, here we have the situation that and we don't know the extent of it, because no one has really done a real study of what the contaminants are. No one has done, as we talk, Mark Reuter, we'll talk a bit about this in a minute, a real health analysis of what's happened to the citizens who live in Turner Station, the communities, and why, and what the cancer rate is, and it may take a long time to figure out where the root is, but what is going on, just even to understand how big the cancer rate is in Turner Station. And that the industry has been reluctant to spend the money to clean up these waterways. Let's talk about some of the contentious issues here that are involved in this. I mean, you know, I want to talk more about Turner Station and the battles going on here, because what we're learning is these issues of environmental justice in our society overwhelmingly affect poor working class communities, overwhelmingly affect communities of color in this country and in our own community here in Maryland. And so now, one of the points of contention here is what should be done. Let's talk about just the immediate idea of how we should clean this up and what should be done for the communities and the land itself and the communities, especially with the people living in there. I mean, one of the contentious points here, and let's talk about why it's a contentious point and what should happen, is a year ago when the Chesapeake Bay Foundation said they were going to sue and get this thing cleared up, and you got involved in this, which is really important that you all did get involved because you are the heavyweights in the environmental community in many ways in the state. You were also going to sue either EPA or the Department of Environment, and you were going to sue the Maryland Department of the Environment, and now you decided not to sue them but to sue only the industry. Let me let you explain that, and I want Mark and Maxine to talk about their perspective on that, and let's have a little conversation about that.
Sure. And you're right. Our original notice letter addressed violations of the consent decree and violations of federal and state law separate and apart from the consent decree, and we identified Arcelor, Severstal, EPA, and MDE as potential defendants. After that notice letter was issued, and even before it was issued, we had begun meeting with MDE and EPA, discussing our concerns, trying to see if they were going to move forward, and in fact got the impression that absent a notice letter, new progress was going to be made. You mentioned a minute ago about the hydrocarbon plume that's coming off of the site. Well, the one that's specific one is leaving Coke Point, where there used to be coke ovens located out there in which they took coal and burned it to make coke, which was used in the steelmaking process. When you do that, you generate a whole lot of different hydrocarbons that are potential carcinogens and hazardous to human health and the environment. What they've since discovered is that now there's a pool of material located in the ground under Coke Point that is now drifting off-site into the Patapsco River. And the one thing that really jumped out at us is that we found data from the company from 2004 that was provided to EPA and MDE that said benzene is leaving the site at concentrations that are like product grade, which means you could go in the store and buy it at that concentration. And it's going far out into the Patapsco River. And we said, wait a minute, you've had this data for 4 or 5 years now. When are you going to do something to stop that contamination from leaving the site? So there were a lot of negotiations going on with the state and the federal government to try them to get to move forward. They have made some progress on some of the claims that we've raised, specific to the consent decree. But our point is, there are a lot of defenses that Severstal and EPA and the governments could raise to attack our case should we sue on the consent decree and sue the government. And we believe that probably the best choice for us as a citizens group representing citizens with a limited budget was to address the polluter. And so we're going to Severstal and Arcelor saying we don't really care much about the consent decree because given the last 13 years, no progress has been made, in our view, to address off-site contamination. We think federal law requires you to do something about that, and we're going to see how this all plays out.
Mark, let me go ahead, Mark. You look like you're about to jump in, so please do.
Well, I want to give a little context to listeners because the situation out there is pretty amazing. Sparrows Point is 2,300 acres. It's also, there's around another 700 acres that actually Baltimore County bought from them as part of a tax deal. So we're looking at roughly 3,000 acres, which is roughly 11 times the size of the Inner Harbor. This is a huge mass of land. It is surrounded on three sides by water, Bear Creek, Patapsco, Old Road Bay, and Jones's Creek. And there is a waterfront of approximately 3 to perhaps even 4 miles. This waterfront that surrounds the plant is unlined, provides no protection from the steelmaking plant to the waters of the bay. Most of it is actually made land, which is slag, which is a porous byproduct of steel. It's waste steel. So the slag that is the perimeter not only contains large amounts of serious pollutants itself, it's waste material, but it's porous.
Let me ask you a question. Where is the slag?
The slag is...
Literally.
Well, of those 2,300 acres of Sparrows Point, roughly 500 to 600, based on my historic research, are all made land.
Including Turner Station?
No. Turner Station is across the Bear Creek and the Patapsco. But Sparrows Point has been, since 1890, been making steel and has been dumping along the perimeter from 1890 to around 1990. It was dumping along the rivers that I just mentioned. So we have made land that is pollution itself, is polluted material itself. It is also porous material, which is why the benzene plume that John mentioned is so readily leaking into the harbor. This is very different from, say, Baltimore Harbor, say, from the old Chrome Chemical Plant and present-day Harbor East, where they've put retaining walls. And so there's no retaining walls. In fact, along the actual border, Mark, and we've shown pictures of this, is debris, huge piles of raw iron, and it almost looks like a volcanic, both volcanic ash and like a series of volcanoes. What Maxine was saying was that around 1990, they began concentrating all the waste products into a new landfill called Gray's Landfill, that not only is adjacent to Turner Station, is just across the river, it is also paralleling the 695 Beltway. And that has now grown to virtually 100 feet high. And so we are...
And what's in this landfill?
That is a good question. The citizens, the residents of Turner Station still would like to know, because as far as I know, when it first opened, there were no regulations. It was supposed to have been a cleanup from all the contaminants from Sparrows Point going into this landfill. So we do not know to this day exactly what's contained in that landfill.
And if I remember, it was a quote either from you or from your recently passed aunt who just passed, led the struggle in Turner Station to deal with this poison situation, that you were just saying that this was just poison being dumped from one place to the other.
Exactly.
It wasn't being cleaned out, it was just being dumped.
It was not being removed from Sparrows Point. It was just removed from point A to point B, still contained on Sparrows Point.
And we know that it is does contain hazardous waste. I mean, there was a lot of waste product that may not be qualified as hazardous waste dumped there, just, you know, dirt and bricks and other things from the operation of the facility. But we do know that basically everything that was a waste that was generated at that plant that wasn't dumped into the canal, Tin Mill Canal, that flows into Bears Creek, was taken to Gray's Landfill and dumped there. And one of the provisions of the consent decree was no more hazardous waste, as defined by federal and state law, could go there. Well, the problem with that landfill, as Mark said, is it's unlined. And we know from monitoring wells that have been stationed, placed along Gray's Landfill, that groundwater under the landfill is contaminated with hazardous waste and is moving off-site.
So what just to clarify, if I may, what we're really essentially dealing with is a hazardous waste landfill that is approximately 2,300 acres.
2,300 acres of hazardous waste.
In essence.
That is could be not just affecting the environment, killing off the fish, destroying the Chesapeake Bay, but having serious health repercussions for residents of communities like Turner Station. That's what we're saying.
That's correct.
So let me do this. We'll take a very short break and come right back. And when we do, I want to talk about whether or not the Department of the Environment and the MDE should be part of this lawsuit and why they're not. What does it take to clean this up? And what comes next? And I think that's something that we should all talk about. We're talking about this hour, stories that were broken and brought out to us by Mark Reuter. Mark Reuter, who now writes for the Baltimore Brew and Online news site. The story was Turner's Station residents say Sparrows Point pollution is hurting land and their health. And one of those Turner Station leaders is with us as well, Maxine Thompson, who grew up there, and this is her home. John Mueller is with us, Vice President of Litigation for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. As I said earlier, we did ask the MDE to come. They sent a statement instead that we read earlier. We may read it one more time as we come back from break. Severstal and ArcelorMittal, the two steel companies refused to join us. Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about what's happening in our communities, why it's happening, and more importantly, what we do to stop it. So stay with us. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. We're talking about Turner Station, one of the historic black communities in our state of Maryland, the fight over a pollution that many think is causing a cancer rate that's exorbitant in that community. We're talking about the pollution that is in over 2,300 acres of land that was caused by the steel industry that gave everybody their jobs. But who's going to clean it up? The Chesapeake Bay Foundation has filed a lawsuit against those companies to clean it up. And that's what we're talking about during the course of this hour. We are joined in studio by Maxine Thompson, a leader and resident of Turner Station, longtime advocate in this battle. Mark Reuter, an investigative journalist who reports now for the Baltimore Brew. He's author of Making Steel Sparrows Point. He's done a huge amount of work in that area, knows more than most people have forgotten. Is that the way you're supposed to say that? Whatever it is, that's the sentiment. And John Mueller is with us, who's vice president for litigation at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And we did invite the Maryland Department of the Environment to join us. They did not come, but we have a statement on our website we read earlier in the show. Severstal and Arcelor Mittal did not want to come on because they said of litigation. Severstal told us that, and Mittal never called us back. So where we left off here, so the question is, let me go through one, two, three, four steps here to understand some things. Before we started this program, when we were standing outside waiting for the other guests to arrive, Mark Reuter, you said to me that you thought, and let's just talk about this for a minute, that this lawsuit filed by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation should have included the state.
And I've written about that in the Brew, yes.
So talk about that. Why?
Well, the article that I wrote after lawsuit was filed on Friday that appeared in the Monday Post and is in there, and it's still, of course, in the Brew, is questioned and brought out the fact that the lawsuit that after 14 months, the original intent to sue, very much emphasized by the president of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, by John himself, and by other officers, the importance, really, of bringing the state and federal agencies to be responsible. Their press releases that I have here repeatedly said that they failed their responsibility over the last 13 years to enforce this consent decree. And so as a pure news point of view, the fact that those agencies have been dropped was news. And I'm hoping John can explain a little bit of the strategy on why taking them out when a lot of their tactics have at best proven to be ineffectual. And I have, in my own work, have not seen and would like to be educated on what progress, real progress, as compared to promises, have been made in the last year that shows that they are getting a handle on this and that this thing won't drag out, as it appears to me it's going to drag out for many, many, many more years.
And I would like to agree with Mark on that, because this consent decree has been going on and nothing has been done about it. The agencies that are responsible for making sure that these companies do this have failed us, because if they have allowed these people not to clean up Sparrows Point. So I think they need to definitely be included in this lawsuit, because it is their responsibility to protect us and the environment, and they have failed us.
So, and John, let me talk about why they were not included in this lawsuit. Why were they not pushed in this?
Well, there is no doubt they were pushed. I mean, they were pushed,
but pushed legally
quite
as
hard.
Part of this lawsuit.
As I mentioned earlier, that the issue became one of, okay, we're going to have to fight two large steel companies. ArcelorMittal is the largest steelmaking company in the world. They have hired, the top-notch law firms to represent them. They have told EPA and MD and us that they are going to fight to the death over the question of whether they have to do anything in the Patapsco or Bear Creek. And so then it became a question of, all right, am I going to spend all of our resources fighting MD and EPA on questions of sovereign immunity? Can we enforce the terms of a consent decree when we're not a party? Or are our forces and efforts better directed at the actual polluter, the person that's actually responsible for the cleanup? Certainly, MDE and EPA bear a responsibility to the citizens to ensure that federal law is complied with and the consent decree is complied with. But federal statutes give citizens the right to file their own actions if they feel that state and federal government aren't doing their job. And that's the case here.
So do you believe that that they are doing their job now? And why the reversal?
They, you mean from the Department of Environment and EPA?
Right.
And DOE?
A year ago, Will Baker and yourself were very critical of
Will Baker's head of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
Right, publicly and in statements. And what's the change in the last year?
I think one of the things that was interesting about the statement that Sherry Wilson provided was that since 2008, MDE has stepped up enforcement. And that is the key point for us, is that from the date the consent decree was signed in 1997 until we issued our notice letter, we agreed that there is very lax enforcement by both the states and federal government. Since that time, I think they have recognized that they have fallen down on the job. There's a new EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, whose number one priority for working at EPA is environmental justice issues. And so they have made Sparrow's Point an issue when it hasn't been for a long period of time. Now, am I going to give them a complete write-off and say they're doing their job completely? No. If they were, then we wouldn't be filing this lawsuit. But, we feel like we don't need to get embroiled in the dispute about whether the consent decree covers something or not, and whether EPA is responsible for doing it or not. The question is Severstal and ArcelorMittal, the companies with the money that have to do this work, liable for cleaning it up? And we say they are.
But so, can I raise one point just to
if raise
I,
one
if
point?
You don't
I have
mind.
A question for you and for Maxine.
But what concrete action has MDE done since 2008? Except for we have one cell that is pumping out some of the benzene pollutants that should be in effect this month. And a grand total of six is proposed over the next year. So there's been some extremely minor improvements there. In terms of the other landfill that Maxine is concerned about and tin mill canal, where has concrete action been taken?
Well, I think you also have to understand how the responsibilities have been divided up between the governments, because EPA has primary obligation for Coke Point, for example, and MDE has kind of ancillary jurisdiction over that. And what they have done is said, based on our pointing out to them, you've had this data since 2004 showing benzene leaving the site. What are you going to do about it? They have now required Severstal to install pump and treat test wells at Coke Point and to develop a corrective measures plan for how they're going to resolve the contamination that's buried under the site. So they have taken action on that point. They have pressed the question of whether Severstal has to do any kind of risk assessment offshore, and Severstal has resisted them. And we don't feel like we need to get embroiled in that whole question of whether the consent decree covers it or not, when we know that there are contaminants offsite. We know they're in Bear Creek. I mean, they're within a couple hundred feet of swimming platforms. And EPA told us that data from the study done by MDE in 1997 was irrelevant to the question of whether a risk
Why
assessment
is it irrelevant? Why do you think it's irrelevant? Why do they say it's irrelevant?
That was my question. That is when we realized that the only way we were going to get action in Bear Creek is if we file a lawsuit.
So let me ask this question. Let me push this a tad further here about this. I mean, so my question would be, Mark Reuter and Maxine Thompson, a couple of things. A, why not file a separate lawsuit with the Environmental Law Center at the University of Maryland or some other group that does this kind of work, or through foundations that are deeply involved in this to help fund the lawsuit? There are a couple of recent short environmental foundations, whether it be Town Creek or Campbell and others like that, who are really involved in this, to take on the battle and include them in the lawsuit if you think it needs to happen. I mean, why is that not what is there a reluctance or an inability or just a resource to not be able to do that? What do you think?
As the resources, and to give an example, there's a litigation that's going on currently with MD and EPA about the hexavalent chromium that was dumped at Maryland Port Authority. There is litigation that's going on with a law firm that has been stalled for 4 years now. Nothing has been heard about this litigation whatsoever. I've inquired with the group that filed the litigation.
Who filed the litigation?
Bill filed the litigation, and they're with Peter Angelo's law firm. And we're getting no answers. They're telling us they can't tell us anything because it's still in litigation. I was approached about having my house tested for hexavalent chromium in the soil. The test, as far as I know, was never done. I was given no results. So we have two consent decrees that are involving Turner Station.
So sometimes, with all due respect to the lawyers and the law, I have a lot of respect for public interest law and lawyers and the battles they do on our behalf. But something that seems to me politically also has to be done. I mean, we're talking about people's lives. You said earlier during the break, Maxine Thompson, that when we were talking about there have been no studies done about Turner Station. Turner Station has been left off the map completely in development and other issues. Talk about it. I mean, give this our listeners a sense of what's...
That is correct. We're talking about litigations, consent decrees, and no one has come to Turner Station and done a study of our water, has a study of our grounds, and people are constantly dying from cancer within Turner Station.
Your own family members.
My own family members. I just recently buried my aunt 2 weeks ago, and she was heavily involved in getting the water and the grounds cleaned up and a health study
and her
done.
Brothers and husband and others involved.
She was not married. Her mom and her nephew,
her
my
nephew,
cousins,
she,
yes.
Right.
And she died of lung cancer, and she never smoked. She developed breast cancer at the age of 24, and she lived right on the water.
So it seems to me that politically there's a lot going on here as well, too. I mean, and I'm not throwing accusations here. If Sherry Wilson was here, I'd ask this question. If Martin O'Malley was here, I would ask him this question. I don't expect Robert Ehrlich to do any better if he ever became governor again, we hope that Martin O'Malley will do something better about this. Yeah. But that there's a lack, it seems, of political will, Mark Reuter, for the government to do something here for some reason, that they're not really pushing the issue the way it could be pushed. And I hope Sherry Wilson was here to kind of respond to that and say, yes, we are, and I'm sure she will at one point do that. But talk about that.
Well, this is what I have found both historically when we saw in the 40s and 50s the rise of pollution at Sparrows Point. It was unregulated by the state. And by the city and county, and began causing these problems that have a long shelf life. This benzene that we've talked about actually comes from a coke oven plant that was abandoned and closed down in 1992. But it so contaminated the soil that it has gone into the groundwater in the last 18 years and has caused this long-term condition. But more broadly, and I think you can see it in the conversation today, the government and in particular has carved out these little narrow niches of what is their responsibility and what isn't their responsibility. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation has carved out what it sees as its responsibility and areas it doesn't want to get into.
Well, let's be fair, Mark. That's not accurate. Okay. I think the focus of this should be on the question of what is the best way to address Maxine's concerns. And the best way to address those concerns, we've tried the government way. And the government way for the last 13 years hasn't worked, the consent decree. And we admit that. What we're trying to focus on are results. And who is ultimately responsible for cleaning up the contamination? And that is the owners and operators of that facility. So if we want action, which is what I think we're all here asking for, is not to continue to go down the same road and ask for government to do something when it seems incapable of doing it or is at a glacial pace. But let's go to the courts and have the courts resolve the issue once and for all. What is Severstal and Arcelor's obligation to address the offsite contamination?
And ArcelorMittal, you just said, and you mentioned ArcelorMittal, would fight to the death with the best lawyers they have on this. So how far, realistically, could this approach get you?
Whether they have their lawyers, if I have to fight their lawyers and EPA's Justice Department and MDE's lawyers, I think I'd just like to pick one battle at a time, given my resources, and focus on the one who's going to have to do something.
What would be – go ahead, Maxine.
Okay, my concern is, okay, you're talking about these battles within the court. My concern is people in my community are steadily getting sick, are steadily dying. And we're arguing about whose responsibility is. I think someone in the health field organization needs to get involved, start doing a study, provide us some treatment, and be concerned about the citizens within Turner Station. Because the courts, these battles in these courts are not solving our problem. We're dying at a fast rate.
And with the University of Maryland and the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, Milberg School of Public Health, do you think there'd be somebody who would take on what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Which is the issue of the health concerns of the people of Turner Station and studying what is really going on. I mean, does Turner Station truly have a larger cancer rate than other communities? And what do we do about all the toxins in the water and the chemicals and the toxicity of the soil and the water? I mean,
so the question is, why hasn't the state of Maryland, why hasn't the Maryland Department of Environment addressed these issues that have been known for 10, 20, 30 years?
Why do you think?
I don't know. I have not gotten an answer there. I think it's a lack of political will that you originally mentioned. Why isn't the EPA broadening the scope here? John says the consent decree hasn't worked, and the consent decree I don't think will work because of the way it's structured, and that's been one of the great excuses, is that it's investigative and not action-oriented.
What is that? In a few short sentences, explain what that means. What do you mean by that?
The consent decree which was negotiated between largely the Maryland Department of the Environment and the Bethlehem Steel Corporation's lawyers, which also was the best lawyers money could buy in the 1990s. Those two parties negotiated a deal over, it took actually 3 full years of negotiations for this around 60-page document. That 60-page document, the Baltimore Brew has shown, has severe limitations to it that were almost written in a way to make it appear like something is going to be done, but in actuality, very little will be done. For example, Bethlehem Steel was required to take care of 3 aspects of its steelmaking facilities. They're called the Waste Minimization Program. Many pages are devoted to exactly what it should do. But here's the catch. Bethlehem Steel must report to the state its progress, and only Bethlehem Steel or its successor now, Severstal, can tell the state that it cannot accomplish the goal stated in the consent decree. Okay. And because of this catch-22, for 13 years they said they've been making progress on something and very little progress has been made, and the state cannot step in and stop this charade and say this is what has to be done because of how the consent decree is worded.
I'm sorry, I'm only butting in just because we don't have so much time left. And I'm curious why, and I want to hear Maxine has to say, but very quickly, John Mueller, why were you shaking your head no?
Yeah, it wasn't MDE that negotiated alone this consent decree. I mean, this was done by the Justice Department on behalf of EPA. The language in that consent decree was very typical of those that were entered into dealing with hazardous waste sites at that time.
So this is a number of government agencies, federal and state involved. It's not just the MDE is
absolutely.
What you're trying to say.
Right.
What were you about to say, Maxine?
My question is, now we're going through this litigation. Now we've gone from Bethlehem Steel to Middle to ServiceDahl. And in these economic times, what is to happen if ServiceDahl decides that it's not feasible to continue to operate and they shut down or they sell this site? Do we have to start from square one again with another litigation? In the meantime, we're still dying. We're still getting cancer. We still have respiratory problems. The water's so bad there, so even the ducks don't stay in the water now. They're coming up out of water, and they're laying eggs around our houses and raising their babies around our houses. People are going out there fishing. There's no fish in the water anymore. And they're telling, they're supposed to, do not eat from this water. We can't swim in the water. It's just horrible.
And we only have a few minutes left here, and I think that one of the answers to the questions that I think that there's a lot of politics involved in this, and the lawsuit that CBF has launched may or may not be successful because you don't know how they could sell the site, and you're exactly right, Maxine Thompson, about what could happen. And some of the big economic development gorillas in this state are the developers, and I'm not just dumping on developers, but they are the big economic agent, and they would love to get their hands on that site and those sites around there and wall them off and try to clean them up. And then they have a waterfront property so that the working class families who live there for generations will no longer live there, and it'll be homes to the wealthy who can buy homes on the water. I mean, I can see that scenario unfolding in the next 5, 6 to 10 years, that could easily happen.
But, what's happening.
And more black folks will be dying of cancer.
I think what you also find with all the delays in litigation is that the parties responsible for this pollution will not have to pay very much, and that it will become a state and federal, meaning taxpayer, amount of money to spend what might be billions of dollars to fix this, or maybe $1 billion.
We're talking here that what we didn't get to, that maybe in our next conversation, is then what is the community, social, and political response to this, rather than just letting it happen to us. But we'll leave that here for today, and we'll come back to that another day, because we're going to continue looking at the situation with CBF, with the community's Turner Station, and hopefully along with our good friend Mark Reuter and the Baltimore Brew, to continue to unfold this and see what's going on. And I want to thank, first of all, Mark Reuter for doing the research and the investigative reporting and the stuff you're doing with the Baltimore Brew. Thank you so much. It's always good to see you. You're a tough investigative reporter. We need more of you in this world. John Mueller from CBF, Vice President of Litigation there. I want to thank you for being here and for the work you all do, and Maxine Thompson for being the fighter that you are from Turner Station for you and your community. It's good to have you all with us. Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.